In our last case today is 2022-99, State of Ohio versus Juba Muhammad Ali. On behalf of the state, Ms. Corgan. Good morning.
Good morning. Chief Justice Kennedy, Associate Justices, may it please the court. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. The erroneous admission of 404B or other acts evidence presents a unique type of harm. Why is it unique? When a trial court erroneously admits other acts evidence, there is almost always a risk that the jury will draw that forbidden propensity inference because there is an inevitable tendency for the typical juror to give excessive weight to the previous crimes and be more inclined to believe that a person is guilty of the charged crime because they committed a similar crime in the past.
Counsel, how did the evidence, in this case, the other acts evidence, how was it allowed? Was there a discussion outside of the jury's presence before trial began in which Hartman, written by Justice DeWine, 7-0 decision, which very clearly instructs the lower trial courts when it is to be allowed and not. Did that take place in this?
No, Your Honor. There wasn't a discussion, but the state had presented that they wanted to introduce the evidence for absence of mistake, for motive, for common scheme, or plan.
So they threw out everything, not just, even though MO, behavioral fingerprint evidence, as indicated in Hartman, isn't relevant when the issue of identity is an issue in the case.
That is correct. So the state just pointed to the permitted purposes. And even when the limiting instructions were given before the other ex testimony was given and then after and before the jury deliberated, it was just, again, pointing to and not explaining. As Hartman says, there needs to be a specific purpose given, or the rationale needs to be explained, but that wasn't done.
So the trial court didn't even follow the direction of Hartman that they have to tailor the jury instruction to the specific reason the court allowed it?
No, Your Honor.
And that did not take place here?
That did not take place.
Hartman came out after the trial courts decided the case, right?
That is correct.
Okay, so it couldn't have followed Hartman.
That is true, Your Honor. That is true.
Did the appellate court have, was Hartman and Smith's decisions out by the time it got to the Court of Appeals?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. And the appellate court also did not explain any of those permitted purposes. Actually, I think the phrase that was used is assuming without deciding that the purposes were followed. And in fact,
are you conceding today that they came in for an improper purpose?
So yes, it was. There was no permitted purpose here, and yes, we are conceding it was an improper purpose. And in fact, in Morris, if you go back to Morris, this court calls the erroneous admission of 404B evidence a singular problem, meaning it is unique. It is not shared by the admission or improper admission of other types of evidence. And because this harm is likely to infect the jury, to infect the outcome of the evidence, and it's difficult to completely excise, it requires more safeguards, warrants a more searching analysis. And such a harmless error analysis was the one that this court provided in Tench. The other test, the Boston test, articulated by the lower court, it does not account for such a specific or such a unique type of harm. So turning to that harmless error analysis, the Tench analysis is different from the Boston analysis in two ways. First, the Tench analysis goes further than asking whether the defendant was prejudiced by the error. It actually stipulates that an error is harmless when there is no reasonable possibility that the other act's testimony contributed to the conviction. Meaning if there is any reasonable possibility that the other act's testimony contributed to that conviction, then that error is not harmless. And second, after the tainted evidence is removed, the Tench analysis does not only instruct the court to weigh the remaining evidence and determine whether it establishes guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, it prescribes the actual weight that is to be given to that remaining evidence. It says it must be overwhelming. And the cases which this court and many of the appellate courts have found that evidence is overwhelming usually involve confessions, eyewitness testimony, direct physical evidence, or some combination of those. So if the lower court had used that analysis or used the criteria in Tench, I believe it would not have decided that the error was harmless. In Mr. Ali's case, the prosecutor couched the facts from over 20 years prior as, and I quote, the framework of evidence in this case. Facts that lacked any probative value to the current case, and then raised those facts extensively in the closing arguments as facts that showed that Mr. Ali had a particular modus operandi. And as Justice.
What was that modus operandi that the state alleged Mr. Ali had?
That he would take women who he hardly knew into his car, drive them to a specific spot.
But the victim in this case was his niece.
That is
right?
Correct. That is correct. Was his niece. However, we do concede that he had just known her for less than a week.
Okay, but if the modus operandi that the state was asserting was how he, did you say, meets women for the first time, picks them up?
So an acquaintance or someone he just knows.
Okay.
And then picks them up and goes to a certain area. And then there is some kind of sexual advance, sexual
and
act there.
Are those similar to the facts in this case?
No, Your Honor. They're not. They're not. Definitely very different, different ages, different facts, different characteristics, very different from those facts. Are different from this current case.
And also, his defense was that identity was not an issue.
Exactly.
He just said this didn't happen.
Exactly. Right? So identity was not an issue. So modus operandi should not even have
Counselor,
come
I mean,
in
I don't
there.
Think there's much question that this evidence, the judge, at least in my mind, the judge erred in allowing this other act's evidence to come in. The question really that we have is this harmless error or not? So why don't you address that? I mean, there seems to be a fair amount of other evidence that the defendant committed this crime, including his own statements, which seem pretty close to admitting to at least some of the conduct.
Your Honor, so if we look at the Tench test, the trial court, as we said, you know, had. It didn't explain any of this. There's no reasonable possibility that the other act's testimony contributed to the accused conviction, or there's no way someone can say there's no reasonable possibility that the testimony contributed.
What about what he told the police? That seems pretty strong evidence against him. He comes as close to admitting that he inappropriately touched her as a person can without directly saying, I did the crime, or I did that crime.
So what he said was that he had showed her some kind of affection. He had hugged her, kissed her, but as he would a niece, a family member.
He also says that he apologized for anything that might have been inappropriate, saying even if it wasn't legally wrong, it would be morally wrong. He says,
uh,
And then when he gets to trial, he backs away from those statements and says he didn't touch her at all. So that seems to be some pretty decent evidence along with the other evidence, isn't it?
So, Your Honor, I think this comes down to more of a credibility determination, because the case actually does hinge on credibility. Who did the jury believe? There is his version of the story, but there is also SB's version of the story.
Let me ask you this. If the state's evidence was that strong, why was it necessary to use this erroneous evidence? And he took the stand in this case, right?
He did.
So that's a decision he may not have made without the other evidence being presented.
That is correct. So when he found out that the other testimony would be coming in, he did take the stand. But it's also impossible to know whether he would have or not without that other testimony coming in.
Although that was argued as a flaw in logic by the dissent in the appellate court decision. I mean, it actually was something one of the judges in the Ninth District felt strongly enough about to point out.
That is correct, Your Honor. That is correct. If we look at, so I want to touch on the last part of the Tench test, which is different, I believe is different from the Boston test. It says that the strength of the remaining evidence must be overwhelming. So, Justice DeWine, to your question, if we look at the Tench test itself, the Tench case itself, it says, this was the remaining evidence after the tainted evidence was removed. There was blood on his boots, on Tench's boots, and this is the Tench case, blood on his boots. There were footprints in the snow leading from where the body was found to where the mother's, where he lived. There was also, there were Google searches on the house computers, including the phrase, kill someone without getting caught. There was duct tape that was found in his basement that matched the tape that was around his mom's neck. That's an example of overwhelming evidence. In this case, there's no confession, no eyewitness testimony, no direct physical evidence. There is nothing that is overwhelming, but it then hinges on that credibility determination. Who did the jury believe?
And so you're saying in this case, inappropriate other acts evidence would tend to sway a jury one way over the other when it's got to be a credibility, he said, she said determination?
It did, Your Honor. It did. This other testimony came in to corroborate what SB was saying. And it then made the jury believe that Mr. Ali was acting in conformity with what had happened before. And therefore, since the Tench standard is the only standard that gives due consideration to the impact other acts evidence can have in a criminal case, we respectfully ask this court to reverse the conviction and remand for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you. My apologies. My docket sheet listed the state as the appellant. So, Ms. Manungo, thank you for correcting us. So on behalf of the state, Ms. Corgan, good morning.
Good morning, Chief Justice Kennedy. May it please the court. Again, good morning. I'm Jack Winnett Corgan for the state, the appellee in this case. This court has already resolved the issues in this that are presented in this case, actually. And it has already addressed the danger that improper admission of other acts evidence poses, that unique harm that counsel discusses. This court did that in the companion cases of Hartman and Smith, which were issued as this case was being briefed at the Ninth District. Those decisions actually came down between the time that Mr. Ali's counsel filed his brief and I filed mine on behalf of the state. So those were standards that And I shouldn't really say standards, because in Hartman and Smith, of course, this court basically re-enunciated the standards that were already in existence, but clarified them and instructed the courts as to how they should go forward in the future with applying them. For instance, with the instruction that in future, going forward, courts are to provide or to examine this evidence more searchingly, and also to provide more particularized jury instructions than the ones that for instance, were present in this case.
Counsel, does the state concede that the evidence that came in, the other act's evidence, was erroneous and should not have come in this case?
No, because there was a proper non-propensity purpose for that information.
What was that?
Well, it basically comes out of Smith, which was essentially to show absence of mistake, intent, and also the fact that a crime was actually committed. Because one of the issues that Mr. Ali put into play in this case with his statements to the police officers when he was initially interviewed was whether a crime had actually been committed, because he was claiming that this was a consensual encounter if there had been any sex at all. And as Justice DeWine pointed out, he all but admitted that there had been.
Does it matter that the two other acts evidence involved adults and the victim at issue in this case was a minor?
No, for this reason, each one of those other people was a very young adult. The oldest was 20. The next one was 19. This was a 16-year-old. All of these women were basically passing acquaintances with Mr. Ali.
Does it matter that these were not family members and SB was?
I don't think so, because really, Mr. Ali had only met this child maybe 48 hours, possibly 90 hours tops. Prior to this. So it was basically the next day after Thanksgiving. This was essentially a stranger to him. Whether she was a blood relation is immaterial. He had no prior relationship to this person. So,
mistake was not one of the issues that was, the jury wasn't instructed on mistake. That's your theory now, but that wasn't really the theory at trial, was it?
The jury was instructed essentially on virtually all of the...
But not absence of mistake. That was not an instruction.
Not specifically, no. But the court instructed the jury that it could consider this evidence for essentially any of the purposes that were present in...
But didn't Hartman and Smith specifically prohibit that?
Pardon?
Didn't Hartman and Smith specifically prohibit the trial court from saying, you can consider it for any of these purposes?
Yes, Hartman and Smith, which again came out during the appellate briefing in this case, said
right,
that...
So the trial court didn't have that. I'm sorry.
The trial court didn't have it. But, you know, going forward, as I colloquially call it to my... my coworkers, the spaghetti approach will no longer work. You can't throw things at the jury and see what sticks.
Well, so and the trial court didn't have the benefit of Hartman and Smith, but the appellate court did.
The appellate court did.
And so shouldn't the appellate court have at least evaluated whether the dictates of Hartman and Smith with the spaghetti approach that the trial court clearly did in this case without the benefit of the cases still makes it error?
My reading of the Ninth District's decision was that it referred to Hartman and Smith for the principles that this court announced in both of those cases, but was not going to hold the trial court accountable to those standards when this court was saying, going forward, we will hold trial courts accountable for it. So that's how I am reading the Ninth District's decision. But again, because Hartman and Smith did effectively address by requiring, by restating the standards, by requiring a more searching analysis by all the parties and by the trial courts, requiring going forward those more particularized jury instructions, if they're requested by the defendant, and outlined a two-level review. You know, the relevance of the evidence is going to be reviewed de novo by a court of appeals.
And also a 403 evaluation, right? That's what Hartman required, a very strict 403 on the issue of prejudice.
That's correct. And Hartman and Smith get into that and how the trial courts are to apply that, and also that gets reviewed on an abuse of discretion standard. But the tougher standard for the Court of Appeals is they get to review the admissibility of it de novo.
Well, so at least for me, you're not going to convince me, at least, that the court didn't err in admitting this evidence. So I think it would be helpful to spend some time on why you think it was harmless error.
Are you conceding that the testimony that this victim, they had a tape statement from her, correct, and live testimony?
Well, taped statement when the victim was interviewed. That wasn't the issue in this one. The other acts evidence that came in was the two prior victims of Mr. Ali.
I guess my point is, do you believe that her testimony standing alone was not overwhelming to this jury?
I believe that this victim's testimony was overwhelming evidence of Mr. Ali's guilt in this case, coupled with the corroborating testimony.
Which was the bruise on the breast.
That's correct. There was some physical evidence, the bruise on the breast, the anal pain. When you go through the record, you'll see some of the medical records that she had some bleeding that she had reported. There was the testimony of her brother, who testified as to her demeanor when she returned home. Also, the testimony of her grandmother, who similarly testified as to her demeanor and what she said to her grandmother. She immediately said that Mr. Ali had at least inappropriately touched her. And the grandmother also testified twice in the record that because of this child's background, having been sexually abused when she was a young child, she does not lie about sexual things. And so you have that testimony from grandmother corroborating what this child said. Mr. Ali then provides a different story to police.
So setting aside prior bad acts, you believe that there is overwhelming evidence that he committed this crime?
Yes, I do. And also, I would direct the court to look at what he said in his statement to police and how a jury could take those statements and wonder why, how could his statement be believed that a 16-year-old who has a same-age boyfriend would possibly want to attract the sexual attentions of a man old enough to be her grandfather who she barely knows.
So if the case is so strong, why would you use the other act's evidence?
I asked my coworkers who tried this case about that, and they used the same language that Justice Stewart said. This was a he said, she said case. And they did not actually parse out to me what they really meant by that. But what he said, she said really means, if the court will indulge me, is in cases like this, where you have the word of a man versus even the partially corroborated word of a woman, chances are that even when his version of events is ridiculous and repulsive, that the jury could believe him instead of her.
But you're not helping yourself now. You're saying that, I mean, what you just said was, well, we put the other act's evidence in because a jury might not have believed her. So if we put in evidence that he did this to other people, then the jury will believe her, which is exactly the reason other act's evidence is forbidden.
But actually, it's not in this case. We weren't trying to show that he was acting in conformity with his character, but to show, like in Smith, that We have a situation that is so similar to what has been done in the past.
It wasn't similar. There's very little similar about these two cases, other than they both involved inappropriate conduct with women. I mean, they're different ages, there's different circumstances, there's nothing similar other than that he did this. I mean.
Well, actually, Your Honor, I would beg to differ. These were very young women. They were barely acquainted or passingly acquainted with Mr. Ali. He tried to get them into his vehicle on false pretenses, you know, that he was going to take them, you know, the first two he was going to he was going to have a modeling assignment with her. The second one, he was going to have he was going to take her to do a catering.
So what about this victim?
With this victim, he told her went to take her home, and then he told her that he wanted to show her something, and took her elsewhere after taking her home. He told her brother that he was taking her back to McDonald's. So he variously says to police that he wanted to talk with her. He said to her he wanted to take her and show her something. She's in his car. He takes each victim to a location where they're not expecting to go.
Most people who commit sexual assault crimes don't take you to places where people can see you. I mean, how is that a unique factor that makes this case similar enough to those that other X evidence should come in? I mean, these things are kind of unfortunately standard with those sort of sexual offense crimes. They secrete the victim. They don't take them someplace where their X will be shown. I mean, how is that so unique that says he did it this time and this is the way this happens? It's so unique that it makes this situation the same.
Well, as in Smith, when you're looking at showing that a crime occurred versus an innocent explanation, it doesn't have to have the same kind of behavioral fingerprint that would be necessary for a modus operandi or an MO, which until the closing arguments in this case, identity was not at issue. So that would have been improper. But showing that an innocent explanation, given these circumstances, is implausible, was the point of that, to show the lack of consent.
You do agree that Tench is the case we should use to determine the question of harmless error, don't you?
And that's where I would disagree, too. There really is no distinction between Tench and Morris.
What about Boston?
Again, it's everything that this court has been doing with regards to the standard for harmless error returns to Morris. It's all the same. And I would direct the court also to Graham, which it issued after this court issued Hartman and Smith.
But Tench is specific to that rule of evidence that's involved here. Why wouldn't we start there? I mean, we can say Morris is, Tench may be based on Morris, but why wouldn't we apply Tench because it's so factually appropriate?
Well, Graham also was a 404B case, and it applied the Morris test and actually laid out the Morris elements again at paragraph 120, saying.
So how would they differ?
They don't.
Okay.
They really don't. And so the state's position is no matter how, you know, how the wording is phrased, it all gets down to the same thing. And that is, if the remaining evidence, once you excise the offending evidence, if that remaining evidence is overwhelming, which means it establishes the defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, as this court announced in Morris, that once that happens, then it's harmless error. And thus, the state would respectfully, in my 7 seconds that are left, actually, I've gone over, we would ask you to affirm the Ninth District. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much. And your time remaining, Ms. Manungo?
Thank you. So I want to touch on absence of mistake, which the state had mentioned. Mr. Ali's defense was not that this happened by mistake. It was that it never happened. So that's definitely something we couldn't dispose of.
Was there some issue of consent?
I'm sorry?
Was there some issue of whether it was a consensual encounter? Wasn't that put into evidence or raised? It can't be both, that it never happened, but it happened, it was consensual.
No, so Mr. Ali said that she had, SB, was the one who had initiated. So was it consensual? He was saying the act never happened. He then goes into, I thought about this, but then did not do it. So he's saying the act did not happen.
Okay. And that's not the case in Smith. In Smith, you have someone who admits they touched the victim in the case, but not in an inappropriate way. That's why we affirmed the conviction, because the other acts showed that that would be an absence of, that would be a true absence of mistake defense.
That is correct, Your Honor. And then I just want to touch on the harmless error standard. Tench clarified Morris, and Tench specifies, stipulates, it has to be overwhelming. The strength of the evidence.
I don't get this Tench-Morris different argument. I mean, they both say that there has to be, they both say that there was, there has to be no reasonable probability that the other act's evidence contributed to the conviction. Otherwise, that there was overwhelming evidence without that. That's the standard. I mean, what difference does it make whether we look to Tench for that standard or Morris? It's the same standard.
I would disagree, Your Honor. So it is different.
Doesn't Tench cite Morris for the standard?
But Tench goes a step further and says it has to be overwhelming, especially that last part, has to be overwhelming.
Well, Tench says the same thing. I mean, Morris says the same thing. They both say that.
So Tench says the remaining evidence has to be weighed, and then it provides a weight that has to establish the burden of proof, that has to establish beyond a reasonable doubt. So that weight is given, criteria is actually
I think Morris
explained.
Is the same thing, but.
I do disagree, Your Honor. We do think that Tench is the standard here. That's the standard that needs to be used. And if we look at the evidence that's remaining, it is not overwhelming. And so we would ask this court to reverse the conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement, and you will receive a decision in the mail. Thank you so much. Marshall, would you please close the court?
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.